Now, how would some of these things differ? Or perhaps the question is, what would be the advantages or disadvantages of collecting oral histories by talking to groups of people rather than to individuals?
Well, it would seem to me that that down the line you would want to have some discussion with the group as to how the information was going to be used, and that they would want to come to some sort of consensus. So that you're negotiating with the group as well as with the individuals.
But for some of these other points, like developing rapport, review by narrators, you know, all of these things change a little bit when we speak of having interviews as a result of a conference.
Would it be unreasonable to think in terms of sending back one or two 60-minute tapes, which would be a selection from the elders' conference to the villages for people to review or to listen to? It would be of enjoyment, perhaps, to those people who were not able to attend, and would give the people who attended a feel for what they had done in terms of a taped product and how it was going to be distributed. And at that time, then get some feedback.
But then you're going to, you're putting it down after developed products, because you have to do all that work. I mean, that's a product.
Yeah.
That's a considerable amount of work involved in producing something like that. Selecting which portions you're going to use, transferring it onto reel to reel, whatever.
Yeah. Getting that review at the local level may not be possible within the elders' conference context. What may be best is to get your translation transcription in writing and then set it up so that someone is reviewing this information in the villages. That is, someone travels to Noatak and talks to the person who gave a particular account and says, "This is how we've translated and transcribed it. Does this do it justice?" That, of course, presupposes that you have it, you know, that you have an Inupia translator there too. This is really a very, very time-consuming and critical task. People who do the translation, transcription, have to be very skilled, and everything depends upon them. But of course, the original tapes you can go back to, but the interpretation here is critical. That's the reason why I suggested that using two people to double check each other is really helpful, and that they need to develop a special relationship to be able to do that. You know, so that they don't mind being criticized. Or maybe have the first person underline things that they're not quite sure of, and the second person come along and give some interpretation.
Could you describe a little bit more about some of the process that you use when you're actually sitting down to do your interviews? You say you usually don't exceed 2 hours, but the amount of work and preparation that went into that 2 hours of interviewing is much longer. Maybe you could just fill us in on what your preliminaries are after you've negotiated everything down to, you know, how the material is going to be used and what your subject matter is. But really the next step might not be to conduct interviews, right? Or it might be to informally discuss the subject matter.
Yes, it's always good to just to talk freely with someone, you know, not to be heading for a recording, but just to talk about the subject matters of people and get them thinking about it, and then if it's appropriate, go to a recording, but maybe it isn't appropriate. The amount of time consumed there is immense. I mean, it's very important to spend days getting a feel for what's going on and honing in on what's most appropriate. Now, this varies. The work that I did with Bob and Carrie Yule, I spent a week talking to them about issues of life in the Kotzebue Basin. Subsistence issues, hunting, fishing, trapping, their life, rural life in Alaska, and some of their observations. And then I did 2 hours of taping at the end of the week. You know, and some people might say, well, you were vacationing the rest of the time. But no, that was critical in terms of identifying specific subjects to be discussed and talking through those subjects so that when we recorded it, we got a rather tight, concise, well thought through description. The work that I did with Howard Luke that I just mentioned, he and I have been talking about doing that recording for, maybe a month or two. And so he's been thinking about the history of Fairbanks. I did very little preparation. We set up the date and I put on my skis and skied across the river and spent 2 hours with him and got an hour's recording. Now I've got to go back and there's a lot more that needs to be filled in. But that gives you some idea of the variations. It was opportunistic for me to catch Howard now before he goes down to Seattle for some medical treatment. So I made a decision of, I'm going to get over there and talk to him right away. So it varies. But the more background information you have, the more you're going to bring to the interview situation.
You see, that's precisely what we are unable to do with the Elders Conference, isn't that correct? You don't have a week to go skiing with someone to do all that.
Well, you may if you go to the villages. If they become village centered, you may be able to spend a few days there before the Elders Conference and get a feel for the background of people who will be participating.
Maybe another way to look at it is to look at that Elders Conference as your warm up. You know, it alerts you to who has information on what subjects and, you know, what groups of people do, and it gives you lots of background stuff, and then you would
go back
if you have the opportunity, right, and really pin down that specific stuff that you want on a one-on-one with a person after you've, you know. But that involves, then, that assumes that we have the person power to review all the tapes and...
But if you had one person assigned to each village, that would be...
11 people.
That's right. I forget that you have some.
And not only that, I think that the big... The main reason they had Elders Conference at the time when they first started off was the intent was that the conditions were that we better get some kind of information regardless what... they had some topics, but they want to get all kind of information before the people die down, you know. So that, I think that was the biggest thing. That now Julie's frustration coming in is trying to, well, where does this fit and try to catalog and all the other stuff. I think that's which is
yeah, and it served a lot of other purposes. Just to recognize the elders and have them all come together is really important.
But Pam, don't they have topics before they meet? Like maybe 1 year subsistence, the next year crafts.
Yeah. They do, but even so, I mean, you can spend your whole life studying subsistence, you know, or I mean, most people up here did, didn't they?
And they may not...
But they do narrow it.
They may not speak directly to the issues. They might tell stories, as we talked about earlier.
Or a lot of them, you know, what you have to do is you have to key them back all the time, you know. Once that you have one person that takes everybody on a bird walk, you know, you sit there and, well, we'll talk about this, and this person maybe didn't pay attention or something like that. Start talking about something and got everybody going, not in that subject, but something else around it. You have to have somebody to try to keep back in there.
That's part of the art of oral history, is that sensitivity to the narrator, sensitivity to the subject matter, knowing when to pull somebody back and when to let them go. The more you know about the subject, the more you'll know whether to, when to pull them back. And the better you know the person, the more you can anticipate when to pull them back. For instance, someone may get talking about dog racing, and it may not seem important until you realize, hey, this guy was involved in dog racing, and I better listen to this. So if you know something about the guy's background, or the woman's background, then it's easier to know when to pull them back and when to let them go. But you have a unique problem with the elders' conference tapes. You have a unique opportunity. And I think probably if you assess the tapes in the first couple of years and you assess them now, in the more recent years, that you might very well see an improvement in the quality, because the people who have been involved have been learning as they've been going along. I'd be interested in that. It'd be an interesting experiment from an educational standpoint to see if the quality is improving.
And there are some kinds of information that really lend themselves to that approach, like getting them place names. You just get a group of people around a map.
Yeah.
No, that is
correct one another.
Information is sort of scattered all over. I think Nana has some, and Manila has some, and the school district has some, and nobody knows who is actually responsible.
We're gonna all dump it on Julie. Decided
whether
she wants
so,
it or not.
That's what's so beautiful about this type of product that I'm pushing so hard, is that once you get it indexed, it doesn't matter where it is, as long as people can know where to get it.
I want to go back to another thing that I've heard you discuss before this lecture, and that was the need to go back to your interview, your tapes, before you start going on and collecting more stuff, the need to work with the material that you get as you get it, rather than to let it. And with the Elders Conference, you have a unique problem, but when you're working one-on-one.
Yeah, when you've collected a tape, it's critical to at least get a rough log worked out as quickly as possible. And a log is just a listing of topics discussed in the relative order. It's critical to refresh your mind about it, and it's critical to get that information down so that the people who come after you will have some basis for knowing what's on that 60 minutes. So they don't have to listen to 60 minutes to find out if there's a specific topic that they need. We can talk about logs in more detail, but they're not that difficult. They're just a listing, you know. So-and-so talks about fishing, then talks about ancestors in the area, then talks about the first school, then talks about the coming of the missionaries, etc. Getting that relative listing, then you have the basis for doing the indexing and any other project. So, but it's very important to deal with the material as soon as you get it, because that's when it's freshest in your mind. You'll also notice something very exciting that happens, at least it happens to me, and that is that when you listen to a tape, you're going to catch things that were said that you didn't hear the first time. And you're going to find, hey, that conclusion that I drew about what he said or she said really isn't true. What he or she meant was something totally different, or something a little bit different, or slightly different. Those types of subtleties are critical. So reviewing the tape will give you a better appreciation for the listening skills, as well as familiarize you with the material and permit the next person coming down the line to have something to work with. Just a few other things, if we've got enough tape to keep going. Tips on taping. Store master tapes, use the copies. Don't use your masters for transcription, translation, logging, whatever. Store master and copy in separate places in case there's an earthquake. Don't tape more than you can curate. Curate is take care of. curating meaning to transcribe, translate, or to index, or to log. That is, as we were just saying, if you've got a tape, process it. Get it through these steps before you move on to the next.
Well, how about if you're in a situation, you know, the person is old and he's sick, they need all the information. It'd be a
then
lot better to go out and get all the information than curate it later. All right?
You've got to search your soul, make some hard decisions.
I can imagine a situation such as Rosa describes where you do have the only living repository for certain information and you just have to get it.
I do it all the time. I break these rules all the time under situations such as you mentioned. But I know that a tape that isn't properly labeled, that isn't processed, really isn't important until it gets into that form. Now, you can have a box full of tapes, and you can say, "We're gonna put people on this. We're gonna get to it," and perhaps you will, but. History tells us that it's better to process them as soon as you possibly can. And yes, there are situations where, doggone it, you gotta put that tape recorder in your backpack and take off and get it, no matter how many tapes you got stacked up. Develop a reasonable curation plan. If you can't follow all these steps, have certain steps that you are gonna follow for the tapes, and have those in a clear, visible place so that you can follow them. I say this, and in my own life, I've got, you know, tapes piled up that I haven't done. So, do as I say, not as I do. While recording, frequently check the quality of the recording. Monitor the quality of the recording. The way you do that is to stop it, reverse it a little bit, play it, or listen to it as you are through the earphone. Label tapes immediately. This is the only rule that I would come down at like a school teacher on. An unlabeled tape is worth nothing because you don't know who's talking. You don't know when they're talking. Anyone who doesn't label a tape ought to have their hand slapped. Selection of equipment. Recorders should have a counter, a digital counter, so you know when it's moving along. Although the counters on different machines are not going to correspond. An external microphone is ideal because then you don't pick up the machine noise. This is an external microphone. It's good to have an end of tape clicker so that you know when you've reached the end of the tape. It's important in the placement of the microphone to place it in a place where it's not going to pick up a lot of other noise that's happening. For instance, if somebody has a habit of pounding or twitching or doing whatever, you're going to pick that up. Or if somebody's moving the mic around, you know, and slamming it and crashing on it, you're going to pick that up. It's going to be horrendous. What I like to do is to put my external microphone right in the box that the tape came in. I usually wrap it around. I use a different type of tape box, but I put it right on there and let it sit. I don't touch it. I keep it away from the machine so it doesn't pick up the machine noise. Condenser mics are not particularly good. It's good to have a battery read on your, that's what I'm missing on my thing, a battery read on your machine. Because if you don't have a battery read, then Then you run into horrendous problems. I carry around with me oodles and oodles of batteries, because I'm never sure that my batteries are good enough. So I got bad, you know, and I always worry about losing the recording. So I got all these batteries, you know, they're just all over. But I never use an old battery when I started recording, because the amount of money and the time that I've spent to get to that person and to create that situation where I can get a recording, it isn't worth it for me to use an old battery. It's much better for me to pay the $250 or more, it's actually $5, and use fresh batteries each time, unless I had a battery read, which is really what you need. So if you got a battery read, you know whether you got the energy there. Finding a place to do the recording is often a difficult situation. When I was out with the Yules, they have CB contact going quite a bit of the time, and they have radios on all the time to hear messages from Kotzebue. So we did the recording out in their old house, and there was no electricity out there, so we had to use the batteries, and we used a gas lamp. Now, the gas lamp did produce some sound in the background, but it wasn't bad. Choice of tapes. Tapes should be no more than 60 minutes, or you'll run into the situation that I did with a tape of a Alaska Territorial Guard scout who was swimming in the Aleutian waters, the oil-slicked waters, when his boat went down, his ship went down, and in the midst of that grueling dialogue, the tape broke. 60-minute tapes are thick enough, so they're okay. 120-minute tapes are too thin, easily broken. 90-minute tapes are too thin and easily broken. Use tapes that are unscrewable so you can repair them if they break. If in the corners they'll have these little screws that you can take out, and that's important so you can repair the tape if you need to. What else should we talk about? Have I missed anything on these items? When we come back, we'll talk a little bit about life history documentation and development of historic themes. But I think we can leave this at this point.
Thanks.
So you might want to speak with just check and see if it's going. You might want to talk with school teachers who had Charlie Edison and get descriptions of what he was like as a young boy. You might want to talk to his relatives. You might want to talk to his contemporaries. And Charlie being a very controversial person, you'd want to talk to people who didn't agree with him as well as people who agreed with him to get a balanced picture. And then perhaps you'd want to ask him about specific things that he did during his life and how he feels about them now. For instance, his speech at the time of the voting for the land claims bill. Asking him about the details preliminary to his voting no. Those would be critical in terms of turning points or critical times in his life in which he had to make very serious decisions. Personally, he felt he had to make very serious decisions. Other times being back in Washington, in which he talked to key congressmen. And then perhaps some of his ways in which he learned to relax or learn to let loose, to release attention, would be important in terms of understanding this personality and his history. So things like going to the Washington Zoo, what's going on there, why is that an important thing? Looking at a personality and knowing enough to build out those types of questions are critical in terms of getting a well-rounded picture. And a lot of that would come out if you spent time with it. But having a list in the back of your mind is helpful in terms of checking it off. Someone like Howard Rock, who's dead now, talking to his relatives would be an important approach to take. Talking to someone like Lale Morgan, who's been collecting information specifically on Howard Rock, would give you a background, a source material that you could draw upon. Looking at the records at Tundra Times, reading over his old editorials, would give tremendous perspective on the land claims issues in the early 70s, late 60s. What are other sources for Howard Rock? Maybe obituaries, you know, notices of his death and what leaders said at that time. If you were doing something on a leader such as Evan Hobson, you would maybe want to examine speeches he made in the context of the North Slope Borough. One of the most famous ones he did was on education and was republished, in which he talked about a nuclear education as he sees it. And then you'd want to know something about the history of the borough concept, and how that fit in with his thinking and his particular place in history. Because it seems to me that when you do a life history, you're dealing with the individual, and you're dealing with a time in history, a time when things come together and are right for that individual to play a significant role, or to be acted upon by those events, or a combination of both. On the so the idea of preparing for interviews is critical. On the life history documentation, let's talk about that a little bit, and then I'd like to have you kind of work on developing some historical themes for this area. If you look at a person's life from birth on up to the point in which you run into contact with them, then in their life, you're going to see that there are important people to this person, that there are significant events which took place during this person's life, and there are special places to this person.
Places as such, as what?
Places that this person associated with. For instance, when you think of Manila, you think of a certain part of the. Is it the Kobuk River? You think of the Kobuk River, and you may even think of certain places on the Kobuk River where he did certain things, or where he made certain statements, or where certain things happened. So, looking at places, looking at events, and looking at other people provides some of the background material for the life history of this particular person. And those are just three things that you can ask about, and three things that you would kind of order chronologically if it was suitable. In developing life histories, you want to see how the individual's life reflects to historical themes of the area, and we'll talk about that in a minute, how it reflects certain cultural values, certain ways the group does things, and how it reflects the person's life reflects the environmental conditions that influenced him, you know. What was his life like as a, we were talking about this a little bit yesterday, Tom, but what was a person's life like as a young boy? What was the yearly cycle then? What was the yearly cycle at the time they got married? What was the yearly cycle when his sons or daughters reached the age of their marriage? And what's the yearly cycle now? Looking at the changes in the relationship of the individual to his environment at those different times will give you some natural time markers for understanding what went on in their life. Life cycle is only one of those things you can use. Other things can be natural catastrophes, environmental catastrophes, or the introduction of something like commercial salmon fishing. You know, well, that's certainly a time marker in today's, if you're doing the life history of somebody today, chances are that commercial salmon fishing would be important. Then the person